This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week. Welcome back if you're a regular listener. I have a terrific show lined up for you today. I happened to catch up with two-time Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul this past week, so I'm going to get right to my conversation with him now. I have the great pleasure of welcoming to the Everything Financial Radio program Congressman Ron Paul, former candidate for the U.S. presidency. Congressman Paul's articles can be accessed at ronpaulinstitute.org. Also, Dr. Paul has a daily program available at ronpaullibertyreport.com. And Dr. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
Dr. Paul, I read with great interest your recent article titled "Congress Fiddles While the Economy Burns." And I want to give the listeners just a little bit of a quote from that article. You wrote, "Congressional war hawks ignore how America's hyper-interventionist foreign policy feeds the growing rebellion against the dollar's world reserve currency status." Of course, the main reason many are seeking an alternative to the dollar is their concern that unless Congress stops creating and the Federal Reserve stops monetizing massive deficits, the U.S. will experience a Greek-like economic crisis. So my question for you, Dr. Paul, is if current monetary policy continues, what does America's future look like in your view?
Well, I think it looks bleak, and I don't believe that we're going to reverse that gradually and deliberately and sensibly. I think that we're sort of locked in it, like we're addicted. The world is addicted to dollars, and we're addicted to it. Even as we speak, they talk about the tremendous effect it might have on our economy if the Federal Reserve raises the interest rate 0.25%, as if this could be the end of the economy. It is so out of context of what a free market should be, but the fact that we've been able to have a reserve currency of the world means that we have been able to export our inflation, and we can dominate the world militarily because the devaluation of the dollar is much slower if people take them up. For instance, if we print a lot of money and circulate it here, but we buy our goods from China, a lot of Americans get mad at that. Why do we buy China? Well, in a way, they do us a tremendous favor. They take our paper money, and then they buy our treasury bills, so they finance our extravagance. They're going to finally get fed up with being the victims of our dollarization. At the same time, they're going to get fed up with us in the foreign intervention, which is part of that article, is that we get involved, and we get involved in places like Iraq and turn that country over to the Iranians, and then we get into more trouble, and people want to go and help China. We aggravate the Russians. So the move now and the speculation is who will, which country will replace it in the East, the Far East. China, in spite of their difficulties with their stock market, they still are a creditor, a creditor nation. They have a lot of money in the bank, and they have been buying gold. So I think our days are numbered, but that doesn't mean that next week or next month you're going to see the final conclusion. But I think the crack is there, and history is on our side that paper money, fiat money, never lasts. It never endures forever, where if you had a gold coin, it's 2,000 years old, it still has the same purchasing power back then. Paper is exactly the opposite. But we're moving into the age where most people are recognizing this challenge on the dollar, and I think it's a very, very serious issue that we have to deal with.
You know, Dr. Paul, given that the Federal Reserve operates largely in secret, minutes of the meetings aren't released until 5 years after the meeting takes place, auditing the Fed seems like a commonsensical thing to do, and for years you've advocated an audit the Federal Reserve bill. Explain to our listeners why this is important, and secondly, why has this idea not gained more traction in Washington?
Well, mainly because the powerful forces are opposed to it. And sometimes if you build momentum for an audit, like I think we had, in the presidential races and after the crisis, they realized that and they had to, acknowledge it. So some now who say, yes, we have more surveillance of the Federal Reserve. There's more transparency than ever before. But they generally come in and they talk about reforms, but they're not real reforms. So you will see some people agitating because there's a public awareness now like it has never been before because of the seriousness of our crisis. But those bills won't do much, and that's why I keep still, through an organization I have, the Campaign for Liberty, that's one of our projects, is to continue to educate people on why you need a thorough audit. And the thorough audit tells you the inside track on who gets bailed out and why they get bailed out and who's getting this money and all the churning, because we would know everything, and especially what they don't want us to know about are the international transactions. And they will throw tidbits about a little bit about what they bought and sold during the crisis, but they can hide trillions and trillions of dollars of transactions that we never get to know about.
Dr. Paul, I want to go back and talk about something you mentioned just a moment ago, and that is that at some point the rest of the world will look for and ultimately probably find a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar for a reserve currency. When that does occur, explain to our listeners how the lives of everyday Americans might be affected.
Well, the big thing will be that interest rates will go up, and it won't have, and Federal Reserve policy will not do anything about it. It'll be because there's been too many Treasury bills being dumped. The Chinese have already started selling, not significant enough to push interest rates up much, but I think the 30-year bond went up. Maybe they're selling those. But what would happen if they start to reject that? Unrelated to Fed policy, interest rates would go up, which means that that would dampen the economy. The economy is going to get much weaker. But instead of prices going down, because everybody's convinced that if you have a weak economy, prices always goes down. Well, sometimes they do, but sometimes you have inflationary depressions. I mean, Zimbabwe had a very weak economy, and yet all the money in the world they won. Even in the 70s, we had a pretty good taste of that, and they didn't know what was going on. They said, the economists came on and said, oh, we have stagflation. Very weak economy, but prices are going up. So they can't control where the money goes. So they've inflated this currency tremendously in the last 7-8 years, but the planners are disappointed because it hasn't gone into stimulating industry and job creation and this sort of thing. But it went where they partially wanted to go. It went in to bail out Wall Street, bail out the stock market, and it kept the bond prices very, very high. So they've just created another bubble. They go from one bubble to another and pretend that the economy is perking along. At the same time, we have 94 million people that are unemployed, and the labor participation rate is under 63% at historic lows. So their policies aren't working. And you'll just see an exaggeration of that. But I think we're going to have a weaker economy with rising prices and no new investments. And I believe that the one side benefit will be that we won't be able to afford the kind of things that we do overseas, aggravating people. And this was more or less what happened to the Soviets in some way, because their economy was never as healthy as ours, and it finally collapsed, and their empire fell apart, and they had to leave Afghanistan. But we could have something along that lines where we will be forced to come back if people won't keep taking our dollars and keep loaning them back to us. But I'm sure not only the fact that we are in so many countries always participating in regime change, they also don't like the way we manipulate the currencies and put sanctions on people, and people will have ill feelings that have been harbored. But if they see that we're weakening, it sort of could be jumping on the bandwagon to come down hard on us, because where we stand today is our economy is a lot weaker than a lot of people pretend it is.
You know, I want to go back to something, Dr. Paul, that you said just a moment ago, that the official unemployment rate is 5.1%, but the labor force participation rate is at nearly a 40-year low. If you were to calculate what the official unemployment rate is using maybe methodologies that used to be used, what is closer to the real number, and how has this system of calculating the unemployment rate gotten so far out of whack?
Well, I think people want, the markets want to hear and respond to the lies. I think they know that, but they say, well, it's going to be an official announcement, 5.1, and the market's going to react, so they react hour to hour. But long term, I think these numbers of labor participation rates and how many people are unemployed are very, very important. And and that's where, you know, where the real problems are, because you know, the employment rate is not going up.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for our segment, this segment rather. Our guest today is Dr. Ron Paul. You can read Dr. Paul's articles at ronpaulinstitute.org, and his daily program, Ron Paul Liberty Report, is available at ronpaullibertyreport.com. I'll continue my conversation with Dr. Paul in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will continue my conversation with our very special guest today, Mr. Ron Paul, in the next segment. In this segment, I want to talk about the Federal Reserve and money. Most of you are probably a lot more interested in money than the Federal Reserve, but it's important if you want to do the right things with your money, if you want to make the right decisions for your nest egg, that you understand how the Federal Reserve works and how money works. Now, if you go back and take a look at what the Constitution says about money, and we talked about this with Dr. Paul, Article 1 of the Constitution says that Congress shall have power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. So we can conclude from this that the Constitution says that money has to be gold and silver. Yet today, as Dr. Paul pointed out, money is paper, not backed by anything tangible. U.S. dollars are now a fiat currency, which means dollars today are used in commerce and are money by decree. The government says that they're money and use them as money. Now, we talk about, and I talk about in my book, New Retirement Rules, this currency money cycle that has existed historically. Seems that this cycle exists because human behavior is predictable and the collective behavior of groups of politicians is also predictable. Money starts out as something tangible, as it has been through most of history. Typically, historically speaking, this tangible stage of the currency money cycle finds money being gold and silver. Then we go to the second stage of the currency money cycle, where paper receipts are often used in place of the real money, but these paper receipts can be exchanged for a fixed amount of the real money of gold and silver. And a good example would be something called a silver certificate that was used in the United States through the late 1960s. If you had this silver certificate, on the certificate it said that the bearer of the receipt was entitled to receive the silver. So a $10 silver certificate entitled you to 10 silver dollars, which contains 7.2 ounces of silver. Then, often because of overspending, and often because politicians and policymakers have only three choices to deal with debt excesses and deficits, they can raise taxes, they can cut spending, or they can print money, we see this link between these paper receipts and this tangible money broken, and money or currency becomes fiat. 100% of the time, historically speaking, fiat currencies have failed, and when they do, typically money now becomes gold and silver again. And this cycle has repeated itself many, many times throughout history. Well, the U.S. has strayed away from this constitutional mandate. And again, the Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Well, the U.S. has strayed away from this constitutional mandate several times. The last time was in 1971 when then-President Richard Nixon ordered his Treasury Secretary, Mr. John Connolly, to temporarily suspend the redemptions of gold for dollars, or dollars for gold. Well, that temporary suspension became permanent because those redemptions have never resumed. We saw prior to the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt ordered that all Americans sell their gold back to the government and the government could print money. Following the War of 1812, there were debts to be paid, and the U.S. strayed from this mandate. Also, during the Civil War, banking laws were changed to allow, again, money to be printed. My point is that each time this has happened, there has been trouble, or the money printing has occurred as a result of the trouble, and the money printing has never solved a problem. Now, today's central bank, which has the power to print paper money, is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve oversees the Federal Reserve System, and even though it says federal in the title, the Federal Reserve is not an agency of the federal government, and many people don't know that. The Federal Reserve is an independent organization. It is essentially a partnership between the government and the private banks. Now, why would Congress want a relationship with an organization that is run by the banking elite? Well, let me give you my cynical opinion. In my mind, it's quite simple. The Federal Reserve can print money or create money and loan it to Congress. Why would Congress want this? You already know the answer to the question: overspending. Congress has three choices to balance the budget. They can raise taxes, cut spending, or print money. And back in 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve gave the government a way to have created money virtually out of thin air. Now, the framers of the Constitution were pretty smart. In fact, Thomas Jefferson warned us against this very thing. Thomas Jefferson said, "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of the very continent their fathers conquered." Well, the Fed is essentially what Thomas Jefferson warned us against. The Fed has been printing money. And when it does, the currency is devalued. And if this money printing continues, your assets, we believe, may be at risk. We know this from studying history, and we know this from looking around the world today. Because when too much money is printed, eventually confidence in the currency is lost. And it can take a very, very long time, but the outcome is very predictable. We can look last decade at what happened in Zimbabwe. The country of Zimbabwe redenominated their currency three times last decade, and the last time they did, in 2009, they created a $100 trillion bill. And we're seeing now the beginning of the end today in the countries of Venezuela and Argentina. And the pattern, not surprisingly, is predictable. The pattern is always the same, as Thomas Jefferson noted: inflation followed by deflation. Or just deflation if money printing doesn't occur. Now, let me explain this, just in the time we have left, as simply as I can. When you have easy money from money printing and make it easy for people to borrow money, they borrow money. If people borrow too much money, they get to a point that their debt cannot be paid. And if the debt can't be paid, then deflation sets in. Now, that may be a little bit confusing to you, but just think about this for a moment. Most money today is debt. Think about the assets on the balance sheet of a bank. Banks are in the business of loaning money, so most of their assets are the liability of someone else. They've loaned money to people for mortgages, for whatever, and their assets are solid assets as long as the people they've loaned money to can pay them back. If, however, the folks they've loaned money to for some reason cannot pay the bank back, money disappears from the financial system and assets disappear from the bank's balance sheet. That's what happened essentially in 2007 and 2008. Now, printing money can avoid deflation, but if money printing stops, deflation kicks in. If money printing continues to the extent that confidence in the currency is lost, inflation or hyperinflation occurs, and then a new currency typically ties to gold or silver, and that currency emerges, and the debt is then redenominated in the new currency, and then deflation sets in, as Thomas Jefferson warned us. Now, if you're concerned about this and you want to study these cycles in a little bit more detail, we do this from a big picture, simple perspective in our new retirement rules class. We've got two more classes coming up during the month of October. If you'd like more information on the classes on October 10 and October 24, just visit the website, newretirementrules.com. The website is newretirementrules.com. You can register there while capacity remains or get more information. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words with Ron Paul.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. In the rich man's world.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. My very special guest today is Congressman Ron Paul. If you're just joining us, you can read Dr. Paul's articles each week at ronpaulinstitute.org and check out his daily program at ronpaullibertyreport.com. And Dr. Paul, when you were in Congress, you introduced a bill titled the Free Competition in Currency Act. And in the last segment, we talked a lot about the Federal Reserve and basically kind of the monopoly on currency. Explain the intent of the bill and why it's a good idea.
Well, I'm trying to introduce and legalize the notion that there should be a market in currencies as well, and that there shouldn't be a monopoly, and that you can have competing currencies. Since our government has failed us, they do have authority to deal with the currency, but they were told through the Constitution that only gold and silver could be legal tender. So they have defaulted on us, and now they commit fraud by just printing dollars willy-nilly all the time and causing these trouble. But what I want to do is legalize it so that if you want to use something else and even use what the Constitution says, that they can't rule against you. If you and I used old silver dollars and said they were dollars, of course they would come down hard on us. So I think the Bitcoin thing sort of introduced the notion that there could be competition. I was never a big champion of Bitcoin, but I argued the case that as long as there's no fraud involved, people should be able to use alternative means of exchange. But I think that competition in this day and age is probably something not too difficult in the computer age. And the only danger would be is if anybody uses fraud. But how could it be any worse than the fraud of the Federal Reserve government and our own government spending programs? But I think this means that you don't have to tomorrow close down the Fed and just say, well, the money doesn't work anymore. That would be a bigger adjustment than we need. And yet that is a threat, because if you have runaway inflation and people desert the dollar, you would have a crash like that. But I think if it were competition and people could opt out of it and compete with the government money, I think that would be a good way to do it. And you have to get rid of the legal tender laws, but you also have to get rid of taxes on money. So if we were using gold or silver, if we purchase and get a gold dollar at $1,000, and then when we spend it and it's $1,500, the government will want to tax us on the capital gains of the dollar, of the value of the gold. So you need to get rid of sales taxes and capital gains taxes, and you need to repeal or alter the legal tender laws to allow us to compete with the government.
You know, Dr. Paul, in the past, you've been an advocate of returning to the gold exchange standard. Could you explain to our listeners what the gold exchange standard is, why it might be a good idea to return to it, and then finally, is it even possible? Is that in the realm of possibility?
Well, the ultimate end of most paper currencies when they stop working is to restore confidence by metals, because, you know, it's happened many times. It happened in our revolution. It happened after Civil War period. It's happened in various countries around the world. But you have to restore confidence. It's usually with a linkage to gold and silver. The gold exchange standard is a lot better off than what we have, but I usually refer to it as a gold coin standard, because you want to be able to, if the government's involved and they're issuing gold certificates, every individual should be able to vote any minute they want. They should be able to walk into any bank and say, here's a gold certificate. I want my ounce of gold. And that's a little bit better than if it's, a bullion standard, an exchange standard, and limited. But anything that would restrain the printing presses would be beneficial. And, of course, we've gone from a pretty good gold standard one time to once, and then we got the Fed in, and it wasn't too long after that we had depression and then confiscation of gold. So we made a little progress backwards because even though officially we can't use gold to compete, we do in the sense that some people ultimately for their long-term savings and their nest egg will use gold to put away and say that in case of an emergency. So that it is a preservation of wealth for a lot of people.
Well, Dr. Paul, you mentioned the printing press, and whenever you see easy money policies, you see not only debt levels at the federal government level increase, but also we have private sector debt levels that, when measured as a percentage of the economy, are greater than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. So given the level of debt that exists in the private sector and on the books of the federal government, is it possible to avoid a major financial crisis, or is one imminent?
No, I don't think it's possible to avoid it. I mean, we're locked in place. All the malinvestment, all the inflation has been, we've seen that happen. So it will be resolved. It's just how it's done. And the debt is a key issue. And the debt, under these circumstances, has to be liquidated. The markets want to always correct the mistakes, whether you made bad investments because you were misled by low interest rates, or you used too much money and you got your debt over your head and you can't do it. So the market says it's out of whack, so they want to liquidate debt. And that's the part that the politicians can't accept, because it'd be pretty bad. But you take the student loan debt, $1.4 trillion, and half the people aren't even paying, and yet just yesterday they announced they were going to make it easier to get a student loan. So it's going to keep doing this until people just finally leave it. And the liquidation, if we were in charge and wanted to correct it, what we would do is just allow the bankruptcies to come. Instead of bailing out everybody by creating another bubble and printing more money, the people who were overly leveraged and they had too much debt, they would have to buckle up and the default would occur. The Keynesians understand that there has to be some liquidation of debt, but they plan to do it by just devaluing the currency. And if you have an $18 trillion national debt and you can get 50% inflation in the next couple of years, the real debt is, cut in half. It's cut down to $9 trillion. So that's always their goal, and they get very frustrated when their measurement of inflation, which is erroneous, and that is the CPI, doesn't respond. Then they say, well, we have to have 2% inflation rate. So they're accepting the principle that they have the authority and responsibility, and it would be real smart to just purposely devalue the currency and make sure that the people who are saving money and there's zero interest rates, those people who want to take care of themselves, they're the ones who are punished the most. So it's a terrible system. But no, there will have to be a liquidation if we allow it to happen. It'd be something like 1921 when there was a crash, there was a depression, it lasted a year and people went back to work, and yet here we are 89 years just propping up bad investments, and we limp along. But eventually I think there will be a major episode where the deflationists, I don't think, even though the market wants deflation, I don't think we really have gotten into that, because the money is still out there. It's just not being used the way the government wants it to be used. And I think that day will come, and then the dollars will be used, and then you will have inflation, and there will be a lot of liquidation of debt.
So, Dr. Paul, assuming that we go back to the financial crisis, if the government bailout of the banks had not occurred, would we have, in your opinion, maybe just experienced a year or two of deflation, some tough sledding, and things would be a lot better today?
Well, I think there would, but I don't think it would. I think it would be even shorter than that if it was a clean break. You just let it go. It would be over quickly. I'm convinced that if you did that, you had a sound currency, and you freed up the market and got rid of the income tax and about 90% of all the regulations, I think that we'd be back on our feet rather carefully. During our presidential campaign, they kept saying, well, you have these plans, but don't the people have to sacrifice? And I said, well, if I offer you no taxes and no regulation, you get to keep what you earn, and you have a sound currency, and you have your freedom back again, why is that supposed to be a sacrifice? So, no, I think if people knew what was going on and the importance of it, people would go back to work pretty quickly. But we're not quite at that stage yet.
Dr. Paul, I believe you stated your view that the stock and bond markets are in unsustainable bubbles. Can you explain how you've come to that conclusion and what you expect for stocks and bonds in the near future?
Well, my own personal view is that, yeah, they're out of whack. I wouldn't buy a government bond or any bond right now, nor stocks, unless it was related to some commodity that I trust. Well, I think it's just looking at it. You know, Bernanke and others say, well, you don't know there's a bubble until it bursts, and I don't believe that's true. I think you can look at it. You can look at what the Fed has done. You can look at charts. I mean, I think it was pretty easy to say that the NASDAQ was in a bubble in the year 2000, which was, I think, the beginning of this unwinding, which has been very, very slow and unwinding. But I think the same charts are available, and the values get distorted, and there's a lot of shenanigans going on. But look along the bonds have been in a bull market, you know, long, probably might be the longest in history, I mean, since the early 1980s. So that is something I just think that from money supply and prices, that things are in a bubble. I think the stocks are doing this. It took a long time. Just think how long it was the NASDAQ was around 5,000, you know, in the year 2000, is below 5,000 now. And if you paid taxes and a price for your inflation, you're way behind. And I still think it's way overpriced. But I don't think you have to assess it and say there's a bubble only after it bursts, because most of the Austrian economists who look at the money supply and this issue as I do had predicted, you know, that it's in a bubble. It wasn't like they said nobody knew there was a bubble and there'd be, you know, a bursting of the NASDAQ or a bursting of the housing bubble. And they don't believe us when we say there's going to be a bursting of what is remaining of the stock market and also with the bond market.
Well, we have time for one more question, Dr. Paul, and I want to shift gears a minute and talk a little politics. Well, I'm sure we know your favorite or have a pretty good idea of your favorite in the upcoming presidential election. How would you assess the campaign in these early stages?
Well, the entire campaign, what's going on, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so many Republican candidates for president, and there's been some surprises in the polls. Any thoughts on why you see non-political candidates seemingly leading the field, at least in these early stages?
Well, it is true to a degree. Of course, Trump represents that viewpoint, and Fiorina does, too. But I look at only the issues and what they stand for, and there's nothing new. It's the same old stuff. And then when you look at the Democrats, I mean, the one that surprised everybody is Bernie Sanders. He's known nothing else other than politics in his lifetime, but he is seen as somebody that's a straight shooter, even though he talks a straight, straight on, I like socialism. He still, it scares me that somebody like that would get as much attention, and then, of course, it bothers me that essentially everybody, with the exception of a relative of mine, that stand for the same old stuff. Are they talking about getting rid of the Fed and having a gold standard and bringing our troops home and keeping the government out of our bedrooms and getting rid of NSA and all these other things? No, they're not talking about it. So whether it's Trump or Fiorina is, she's moving up right now, but if you listen to what she says, it should frighten people. But I just don't like the strong man approach. I always said that I wanted to run on the things I don't want to do. I don't want to run your life. I don't want to run the economy. And I don't believe that our government should be running the world and policing the world. So in a way, it's exactly opposite of people saying, I can do this, I am the best, and I can run the world like nobody else can, and I can tell people what to do. That sort of thing is absolutely opposite of a libertarian view.
Well, Dr. Paul, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a great pleasure having you on the program. I've been a big fan of your work for years. Keep up the good work. You can catch Dr. Paul's daily program at RonPaulLibertyReport.com. I'd encourage you to do that. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words.
I said money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to our very special guest today, Dr. Ron Paul, for joining us. You know, last week on the program, I began to talk a bit about some of the emerging and intensifying economic winter season symptoms. And what I mean by that is, if you've been a long-time listener to the program, you know that it's our belief that because human behavior is predictable, that economies and currency and money all cycle. And these cycles repeat themselves over what are fairly long periods of time. Well, when easy money is prevalent, like it really has been over the past 25 years or so, you find that people borrow money and debt levels reach unsustainable levels. And when debt levels reach a point that they're unsustainable, then we see deflation and other painful economic symptoms kick in. So taking a look at what's going on now as far as the economic winter season is concerned, I want to expand on what I started to talk about last week and maybe expand a bit upon what Dr. Paul talked about on today's program as well. You know, back in 2007 and 2008, there were a number of banking failures. And one of the prime reasons that we saw banking failures was, number one, the assets on the books of the bank were toxic. In essence, they were bad loans. And two, there were a lot of derivatives, or really side bets, between banks. Now, it's my view, and I talk about this in the second edition of my book, New Retirement Rules, there will have to be more banking failures moving ahead. And it'll have to be, I believe, even on a larger scale than what we've experienced 7 or 8 years ago. I talked about this on last week's program. However, the too big to fail banks, frankly, are bigger. So taking a look at the derivative exposure, and if you're not familiar with derivatives, I'll give you a brief explanation. And just to keep it simple, a derivative is not really an investment in anything. If you buy a stock, for example, you're purchasing an ownership interest in the company. When you buy a bond, you're loaning a company money, and the assets of the company are at least partially collateralizing your loan to the company. But a derivative is different. Essentially, a derivative is a bet about what will or will not happen in the future, such as, for example, interest rates moving up and down. Well, the derivative exposure of the too big to fail banks is presently $278 trillion. And as I said on last week's program, that's about 28 times the size of the banks. A CEO of one of the too big to fail banks wrote this to shareholders not long ago. I shared it on last week's program. He said in his message to shareholders that some things never change. And I'm quoting, "There will be another crisis and its impact will be felt by the financial market. The trigger to the next crisis will not be the same as the trigger to the last one, but there will be another crisis." That being the case, as I have already forecast, and I'll get into this in a bit more detail in a moment, I am forecasting a significant downturn, in the stock market because we will see, I believe, another financial crisis. Now, in addition to that, since 2007, worldwide, debt levels have increased by more than $57 trillion. That's an increase of 40% in the last 8 years. And you see the central banks, and I talked about this with Dr. Paul today, central banks all around the world have delayed a lot of the deflationary symptoms that we would expect as a result of all these debt excesses. However, this money printing can only mask deflation for a period of time. And essentially, this money creation will lead, I believe, to trade wars, lower labor force participation rates, even lower than it is today, lower commodity prices, and I think we'll see fiat currency failures. In fact, we're already witnessing the beginning of each of these trends. See, as currencies are devalued, a country's exports become more attractive and imports to the country become more expensive. So in an attempt to boost economies via exports, currencies are being weakened. This competitive devaluation of currency can lead to currency wars, which are in essence trade wars. And trade wars cause world trade to decline, worsening the symptoms of deflation. Now, trade wars occurred during the last economic winter season of the 1930s through the use of tariffs. And this time around, although some U.S. presidential candidates are advocating the use of tariffs, and if you watched the Republican presidential debate last week, you see that some of these candidates are saying we need to protect ourselves. We need tariffs, which I think history proves has not worked out very well. And I don't expect that we'll see the use of tariffs. I think that currency devaluation will be used primarily to fight what I see are upcoming trade wars. Now, my forecast for the market specifically the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is still that we'll see the level of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the price of gold per ounce reaching parity. They will be equal. Now, it's difficult to forecast a particular level at which the Dow and the price of gold per ounce will meet, but I would not be surprised to eventually see a level of $3,000 for the Dow and for the price of gold per ounce. That may seem unfathomable to you. You may say, that can't possibly happen. That guy on the radio, he sounds like a lunatic. But let me remind you, a decline of 90% in the Dow seemed impossible in 1929, when private sector debt levels were much lower than today when measured as a percentage of the economy. That's right. Private sector debt levels today, when measured as a percentage of the economy, are 50% greater than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. Unemployment seems pretty good when you look at the headline rate, 5.1%. But that's very misleading, because the way the unemployment rate is calculated has changed. If you calculate today's unemployment rate using methodologies that were used prior to 1994, and I talked to Dr. Paul about this, there are those that would estimate the actual unemployment rate to be over 22%. And the labor force participation rate is presently at 62.6%, which is a 38-year low. And interestingly, those 55 and older, the number of folks in the labor force in the last 15 years in that age group has increased almost 60%. So this lower labor force participation rate is evidence, more evidence, that the deflationary symptoms of an economic winter season are upon us and ready to intensify. Now, I talk about more of these economic winter season symptoms in the epilogue of the rewrite of the New Retirement Rules book. You'll be getting a copy of that book if you enroll in the New Retirement Rules class. We've got a couple classes coming up in October, one on the 10th, one on the 24th. To get more information or to enroll, all you have to do is go to newretirementrules.com. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. All the information to enroll, all the information about the class is listed there. Let me also remind you, we do have a couple of Social Security maximization dinner workshops coming up in October, one on the 8th at Boulder Creek, one on the 15th at Watermark Country Club. That information is posted on the website, socialsecuritydinner.com. The website, again, socialsecuritydinner.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye.